Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why incumbent politicians wield so much power and why those politicians stay so long. 8th District Congressman Rick Nolan's decision last February to retire startled Minnesota DFLers. At the time, the district's DFL chair said the decision caught him off guard. Nolan ran briefly as a lieutenant governor candidate with Attorney General Lori Swanson. But most politicians retire from politics only reluctantly. They might be facing a powerful primary challenge, they're swamped by scandal, they're old, and they don't have to retire because there's so much power and money in incumbency. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you as voters. Do you think years, and often years of service in politics, is healthy for our political system? Is it difficult for younger people who want to serve to break in? Is that value of experience something that really needs to be considered when we talk about how long politicians decide to do these jobs? If it's a problem, we'll talk about the remedies here, and I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about that. But what do you think when you see long terms of service and the power of incumbency? Difficult for new people to break in? We should value that experience of people that go to Washington or go to the state capitol and really understand what they're doing. Weigh the two ideas and join the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about it as you are on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Samara Klar is with us. She's a political scientist and professor at the University of Arizona, and she joins us today from Boulder, Colorado. Samara, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Carrie. It's great to be back.
Samara, if you scan down through the list of members, as I did, of the U.S. House and Senate, oh my gosh, you will find terms that go from 25 years to nearly 50 years. Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, who is finally retiring at 84 years old, has served nearly half of his life in the U.S. Senate. Tell me this, do we have a system that once you get in, there are a lot of forces that kind of accrue to keeping you in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for good and for bad, we see that there does absolutely exist an incumbency advantage. And, you know, the specific percentage in votes that the incumbent tends to get simply by being the incumbent has been debated among political scientists for several decades, but it exists. It's probably around, 3 to 5% potentially. And that's just, that can really make or break an election. So incumbents have a real advantage, and it's largely due to name recognition, more fundraising, more familiarity with the constituents. And so, yeah, we absolutely see that. And there are reasons why we might want to see that. You know, an incumbent has more experience,
right,
has more knowledge, has
right,
institutional memory. But, of course, as we're seeing lately, and I am seeing in my own research, Americans are really starting to crave new faces, sort of people from outside the traditional establishment.
And do you think that is because there is so much longevity, particularly in the U.S. Senate and in our state capitol? I presume that this is the case in other state capitals. Or is it just because we are a fractious, restless electorate and the outside usually looks better than the person that we know?
Well, it's hard to say exactly why Americans have recently started to turn against the establishment, but I think one primary cause that I've identified in my work is just that increasing negativity in politics. We've seen such a rise in negative rhetoric in speech, in the way candidates are attacking each other, in the way sitting politicians are attacking each other. I think there's sort of a sense that if we elected some new people, maybe we would get rid of this real angry environment that seems to have fostered among our existing political
and
elites.
Does that happen? I mean, the Tea Party made that argument, I think, 8 or 9 years ago. Did that happen?
I'm not seeing any evidence at all that new outsiders are bringing more civility to politics. Absolutely not.
And why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, I think the tendency among outsiders is to really fight against the insiders, to try to get them out, to try to prove that they are there to fight for what they want, that they're not there to compromise.
Yeah. Let's take a call here from Kim in Hastings. Hi, Kim. You called right away on this show. What are you thinking about?
Yes. Hi. Thanks. I'd like to talk about, you know, very local elections.
Sure.
For our county judges. These judges are appointed to begin with. And once they're in, they stay in. I know this. Nobody researches the record. A lot of times we don't even know what the judges, you know, records are. And this, I think, is important because some of these judges end up being Supreme Court justices. So people just keep checking the box. There's really no information about our county judges, and they are very much biased.
Kim, let me take what you just said. I think that's a really important point, which a lot of attention, Samara, goes to people at the top of the ticket. Often it is the down ballot candidates who coast on name recognition because a lot of the voters don't, as Kim suggests, do not have a good idea about their record, what
Absolutely.
They stand for.
I mean, I'm seeing this even within my own family, as my family members and myself are looking at the ballots or early ballots trying to figure out how to vote, who to vote for. You see judges, you see a lot of local officials that you may not be familiar with who might not have money to be campaigning, to be advertising. You see all sorts of propositions that you might not necessarily be familiar with.
Right.
And there is indeed a tremendous burden placed on the voter to do your research, to my husband the other day was Googling candidates online trying to figure out what some of these people think, because a lot of them are very local. They have very small budgets. And as voters, we don't know a lot about them. Now, you know, most cities send out their voter guides, and there's all sorts of organizations, the League of Women Voters and other advocacy groups that, try to put information out there. But absolutely, there's a huge burden on the voter to really be informed.
Samara, I'm going to bring Jeff Blodgett into our conversation. He's a political consultant and he's founding director of Wellstone Action. And Jeff, you pulled off something that is often quite difficult for a candidate, which is an upset of an incumbent that Minnesotans were very familiar with. So welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. It's nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about what the mountain looked like when the late Senator Paul Wellstone decided that he would run against Rudy Boschwitz, a very well-known and pretty well-liked incumbent.
Yeah. Well, in 1990, and it was definitely an example of a strong incumbent losing in a year when most in other U.S. Senate incumbents won. I mean, at the time, no one really wanted to run against Rudy Boschwitz. There were several prominent names, including Mr. Mondale, Vice President Mondale, who declined to run against Rudy Boschwitz.
Wow.
He just seemed too powerful. He had $7 million in his bank account. And so Paul Wellstone decided to go for it. He thought he had a outside chance running a very unorthodox campaign. He was outspent 7-1. What was interesting, though, is that I think it's a combination of two things that happened. One is, Wellstone was only known by about half the electorate on election day.
Uh-huh.
So it was a vote against Rudy Boschwitz, and Wellstone had put himself in the position running a creative campaign with very little money, but with a lot of spirit that got him into a position to take advantage of mistakes that Rudy Boschwitz made in the final weeks of the campaign.
You know, Jeff, you're bringing up a really important point there, which is so many people did not know who Paul Wellstone was or what he was about, that he had the space to define himself. That maybe is the power that the incumbent doesn't have and the new challenger does have.
That's true. That's right. You get a chance to start from scratch with voters and introduce yourself the way you want to. We also had that space because Rudy Boschwitz ignored us until it became almost too late for him. He thought he could just cruise on to victory and not worry about this challenger until about 2 to 3 weeks, when the race kind of turned on a number of events. And he did start taking on Wellstone, but at that point, it was a little too late.
Samara, I think you'll get a kick out of this. Jeff will be familiar with this ad. It's then-candidate Paul Wellstone basically seeking Rudy Boschwitz, the incumbent, to debate. So listen to this.
When I decided to run for Senate, there was one thing I was looking forward to. So, as it turns out, were a lot of you.
Well, I expect that there will be some debates.
I'd love to see you debate with him.
Well, I think there should be debates, yeah.
Getting a hold of the person I had to debate, however, proved easier said than done. I tried everything. I mean everything.
Boschwitz was here.
You can hear a lot of humor there, Samara. What else is happening in that ad?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Jeff raises a really great point, which is that the incumbent runs a risk of not taking their opponent seriously. And I think a lot of people would argue that is exactly what happened in the Republican primary race in 2016, that most of Donald Trump's candidate opponents just didn't quite take him seriously. And when we see that, when we see, you know, an established partisan veteran not taking seriously these outsider candidates, lately, that has led to a lot of upsets, and that's what we're hearing in that ad. Somebody from the outside not being taken seriously, not given their due respect as an opponent, and ultimately they win.
You know, Jeff, there's also this issue, and I know challengers to incumbents have tried this with some measure of success. They're out of touch with we the people back here in their home state. They've become Washingtonized in some ways. Was that an argument that you think came in with the late Senator Wellstone, but that you see other candidates using as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think that most people in general don't like what's going on in Washington. Oftentimes they like their own representative, but dislike what's happening in Washington. So if the incumbent tips too much to being kind of the insider, using Washington language, touting his power in Washington, that kind of thing, that's a signal that maybe they've lost touch with what voters are really, really care about in their district.
Jen says this on Twitter, and this is a good point about experience that I want to talk to you both on. She says, I think there's value to having representatives spend a long time in Congress. There are learning curves and split leadership, some years same party in power, others not. However, incumbents need to remember they represent their constituency, which changes over time. And then she adds, that said, we need fresh, more diverse voices representing us. I see value in both, which is why, Samara and Jeff, you both being experienced here, I think this is an interesting discussion about you want someone who knows the ropes, Samara, in Washington, because in some ways you represent your constituents better that way. But at some point, it becomes a question of, are you serving more of your self-interest by staying? Are you blocking other people from coming in? How do you see that question?
Well, you know, this is a question that political scientists have taken a real look at in their research. And there does seem to be an advantage in terms of representing one's constituents for those who stay longer, who are not term limited. And it's because of the points that, the commentator that you quoted just raised, that an incumbent who's been there for a long time doesn't have to spend all of their time increasing their name recognition. Fundraising comes much more easier to an incumbent. They have the institutional memory. They know how things work. They know other people. They know people across the aisle. So these things do tend to help when it comes to representing. However, the demographics of a constituency might change dramatically over the course of 30 years that somebody is in Congress.
Right.
So the people that they were elected to represent might not even live there anymore. We might be seeing a completely different town or district than we once did, and that's a real problem.
Jeff, you have an interesting view. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I'm not a fan of term limits, but I am a fan of competitive elections, and I think that actually is the antidote to this incumbent problem, is having competitive districts with competitive races where people have to stand for re-election and they have to come back and they have to make their case. And then challengers get the chance to make their case as well.
So, Jeff, when you talk about competitive districts, I think you're alluding to gerrymandering, right? Which has created a lot of safe districts for incumbents. Yes?
Right. Which could be one of the greatest incumbent advantages if you're in office when the lines are drawn, you get to have a say in what your district looks like.
You know, I think there are some questions on the ballot in places, I want to say Idaho, where they're voting on whether to create a citizen commission for gerrymandering, mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. redistricting after the 2020 campaign. Jeff, is that the answer? Because I've seen experiments, or I've seen this in action, I think, in Arizona and California, where it doesn't really eliminate the politics out of it.
No, but I do think more has to be done to reduce the level of politics involved in redistricting. If you look at what happened in many states after the 2010 election, it was a bad election for Democrats, and this whole decade has really been dominated by lines at the state and congressional level, which aren't necessarily fair and balanced. And so I just think we have to do better to create districts that are fair and balanced and create more competitive races.
Jeff Blodgett with us, if you've just tuned in, as we talk about the power of incumbency. He's a political consultant, familiar name to political observers here in Minnesota, founding director of Wellstone Action. And Samara Klar with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Arizona. Samara, what's the research tell us about the power of those citizen commissions when it comes to more fair redistricting?
You know, I don't know if there's been enough research yet to tell us how, sort of allegedly nonpartisan citizen commissions can help affect gerrymandering. But the evidence of gerrymandering working against its original intentions is overwhelming. I mean, when we compare the way that districts have been gerrymandered according to the rules set out with sort of more objective maps, we see huge discrepancies. So, you know, districts are supposed to be as few districts as possible. They're supposed to be equally distributed, and they're supposed to be contiguous. We're not supposed to see these crazy shapes. But that is completely counter to what we actually see in most states. We see a lot of districts, bizarre shapes, you know, these crazy question mark or like Tetris pieces. And we know immediately that these are not done fairly. They are done with partisan goals in mind. And that is just simply not the purpose of redistricting. And I agree completely with Jeff. This is a huge problem. I think it's finally gaining a lot of, outrage among the mass public. And hopefully these commissions will actually become fruitful. We're going to have to wait and see.
So as you listen to our conversation develop, I hope you'll weigh in here. Do you think years, and by the way, in Congress, often many more years of service in politics, is healthy for our political system? Does it make it difficult for younger people to break in? But what about this level of experience where you really start to understand and wield some power in Washington on behalf of your constituents? How do you weigh those two ideas? What's the remedy? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, where Mark says, with the Kavanaugh hearing and the reference to Anita Hill hearings, which seemed forever ago, they were nearly all there. I have to admit that every time I hear Mitch McConnell speak, I want term limits, but then unelected bureaucrats would be in charge. So that's a bad idea. To Manny in St. Louis Park. Hi, Manny. How do you see this? Hey, Manny, are you there? Oh, shoot. We might have lost him. Darn it all. So, Jeff, as far as coming back to this idea of redistricting, and citizens' commissions and, you know, putting these ballots on the question, do you think, or are these questions on the ballot, do you think this is more of an indication that constituents are tuned in to this issue and more knowledgeable about these weirdly drawn districts, and legislatures are going to face more pressure from voters who want this to be fair?
Well, I do think there's more awareness about it, especially as people have seen what happened after the 2010 election and redistricting. There's some states that are pretty outrageous examples of gerrymandering. Pennsylvania, an example where, you know, it's generally a Democratic state at the presidential level, but its congressional delegation is overwhelmingly Republican. And that is really just a matter of how the lines were drawn. So there have been some outrageous examples of redistricting in the last several years.
Also in Wisconsin, by the way. Yeah.
Yes. Wisconsin, too. Wisconsin locked in legislative majorities through their redistricting process, and it will really take going through another redistricting before that changes. So I just think that's wrong. I think it's wrong for either side to do that, and that what we really want is more competitive elections with fair districts that that give people a real chance to take out incumbents or an incumbents a real chance to make their case legitimately to voters.
Yeah, you know, Samara, I'm curious about this because when we talk about the issue, wow, our callers are knowledgeable about this and really engaged on it. What often seems to happen is it goes up through the courts and it you know, voters rarely get to weigh in on this. And that's why I'm curious about whether these citizen commissions are a sign that more voters are saying, I want some control over this. I'm not satisfied with how the courts handle it.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's largely, it's largely a grassroots effort. We have seen a lot of lawsuits recently. For example, the League of Women Voters, which I mentioned before, they bring lawsuits on behalf of the Democratic Party, arguing that many of these redistricting plans are unconstitutional. So it has been coming up through the courts, often from the ground level. And, you know, the citizen commissions are showing a little bit of promise, but we still need a few more years, a few more data points to figure out whether or not they're going to be the solution.
Okay.
You know, I think the benefit of getting this redistricting issue into the public consciousness is that people become aware of how important it is to vote, even in these midterm elections.
Right.
So, you know, it's often people feel as though they vote for the president because that's something that they feel really importantly about. But in the midterm elections, as a previous caller was saying, you don't know who the judges are. You don't know who these school board officials are. And so voting just doesn't seem quite as relevant. But these are we are forging the path for who is going to be able to do redistricting in the future. And I think that's something that people are really starting to understand.
Yeah, good. Mindy says on Twitter, I don't think any political office should be a job for life. There should be lifetime term limits for Congress as there are for president. It's important to turn over those seats to bring fresh ideas and energy into our governing process to reflect current concerns. I'm going to get to term limits here in a minute. I think I heard Jeff saying he's not a big fan of them. To the phones to John in Minneapolis. Hi, John.
Hi, I'm curious. I'm 37, and, you know, I've got a couple parents that are 80 and 70 years old, and, you know, they happen to vote the way I do. But that said, my parents, I expect, with modern medicine and their general health, are going to be around for probably 15 to 20 more years.
Uh-huh.
And they're you know, the like. And I'm just wondering, how do your guests feel that, you know, with the technologies that's evolving, certainly that gives us the opportunity to get more information more quickly, and to be more aware with data points about, you know, how people vote, say with redistricting or say with just generally like information for voters with this broad spectrum of candidates.
Yeah.
Do your guests think that the biggest challenge we have is literally just fighting this sort of latency with the generational gap that, you know, our generation is more keen to like maybe say, hey, maybe the government should put money into just making voting and information gathering acceptable to all very quickly, like through public funding? Or do we just let sort of the baby boomers that are technically running most of the Congresses in the United States presently just sort of like slowly come in the next 20 years before they die?
Such a good question.
Thing.
And, you know, John, what your question reminds me of is, do you remember when Mark Zuckerberg testified on Capitol Hill? And there were the most inane questions about the Facebook and technology. So this is a really good question. Samara, what would you say to that?
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, the research tends to suggest that term limits might not necessarily be a panacea here because, as several callers have mentioned, you know, there is a lot of experience that comes with being in Congress. However, I think what we're seeing is that challengers are much higher quality potentially in recent elections than they have been before. So, you know, one of the reasons that incumbents tend to have such an advantage is that when someone has been in office for a very long time, the opposing party is much more reluctant to run a high-quality challenger against them or to spend a lot of money in the race against them because it sort of seems like a waste of money. It seems fruitless. But what we're seeing recently is even, you know, traditionally, what we would traditionally consider to be a high-quality challenger or a high-quality incumbent is receiving real high quality challenges. So I think this sort of myth that challengers have no chance against these long-term incumbents is dwindling. So potentially what we might be seeing, and maybe this will be seen as optimistic for your caller, is more and more high quality challengers taking on these long-time established incumbents.
Yeah. I, Jeff, I really like what John's asking there too about, you know, technological change may solve some of, I think, some of the most urgent questions of the democracy, right? Who gets to vote? How do we vote? And I think, as he's suggesting, it's a very slow movement to change because of the generation that's in power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Although I do think, to the caller's point, too, it is easier and easier to get information on elections, on who's running, on the candidates and their positions and platforms. And not that everyone's taking advantage of that, but it is getting easier. And so I think if we do have quality candidates running, and I think that's an important point that Samara made, quality challengers who are running that capture people's imagination, that give people a real choice, a real option from their incumbent, then that will help. That could spark more interest in elections. And I do think that it's easier and easier to get that information out as a challenger, given all the different channels that you can communicate with people too. So there's actually some positive signs for challengers in the future. And I also agree that it isn't just necessarily, I think that there's a lot of examples now. This year, we'll see. We have 1 week to go, but right, there's a lot of examples, I think, of challengers who are really taking on incumbents in pretty strong ways, even though there's advantages that those incumbents have. And many of those challengers may very well win.
Yeah. You know, Samara, I was just thinking about the late Senator John McCain and what mm-hmm. happened when he had that primary challenger in the race before this most recent one, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It forced him to reconnect. I mean, it forced him, I think, to the right on some of the issues that he had been quite moderate on. But it also forced him to reconnect with people in his district. It forced him back into truly listening to his constituency. So a hard, good primary challenge can be valuable, can it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we tend to hear, you know, even when, let's say a Republican runs in a very blue district and comes close to winning but doesn't quite win, or when we see the reverse happen, when a Democrat comes close to turning a seat, the party will often say, well, you know what, our goals have been achieved in many ways because we've actually changed the platform of the incumbent. And it sounds like sort of like something a loser might say to make themselves feel better, but it is completely true. You know, these challengers are doing the public a real service by forcing these incumbents to reconnect with their constituencies, to polish their platforms. And they are also doing themselves a service in, you know, setting the stage for potentially a future in politics.
Yeah, that's right. Here's a call from Colleen in Iowa. Hi, Colleen.
Hi there.
What are you thinking about?
I'm calling from the land of Steve King and our friend Chuck Grassley.
Oh, yes.
God help us.
Yep.
But I just was telling your screener that how unresponsive, completely unresponsive, Chuck Grassley in particular has been to any kind of discussion with those who hold different opinions or who would prefer that he think before vote so straight line, the way he has been following the Trump administration in particular, and certainly in costing us a justice appointed by President Obama. And my own self have probably called and or written 100 postcards to him and get nothing but form letters back, if anything at all. He does not represent me, and he doesn't have to. And part of that, I'm wondering if it isn't just there's so much money in the incumbency. And, you know, it kind of goes back to me to should we, of course, at Citizens United is an issue here, too. But to just saying each candidate gets X to campaign with. Let's see what money managers they really are. Let's see how successful they are getting their messages out on a limited budget and literally limit their budget.
Yeah.
I think that would limit just by nature how long they are in office by you'd have to be accountable to your constituents and not just big money that keeps the incumbents, you know, in a very soft, cushy, comfortable place in Washington.
Yeah, interesting point here, Colleen. By the way, some context. The average cost of winning a House seat now, $1.5 million.
Okay.
For a Senate seat, $10 million. And the numbers have doubled since 1990. So we'll get a look at the latest news. And when we come back, we'll talk with Samara about how, in some ways, incumbents with the name ID that they have shouldn't need as much money, but they bring in huge amounts of money because it's the power of the incumbency. So we'll talk about that on the other side of news. Want to hear from you on term limits and some of the other suggestions. Jeff, really great to talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course, Carrie. Thank you.
Conversation about the power of incumbency and what's happening with challengers. And Samara Clark continues with us from the University of Arizona, bringing Andy Bremen now. He's a corporate attorney and former press secretary for U.S. Senator Norm Coleman. Andy, good to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot for having me.
Hey, we were just about to talk about money, and I want to ask you about this contradiction. When you have an incumbent, as Senator Coleman was for well-known, maybe I should say that, well-known in Minnesota politics, mm-hmm. Does that open the door to more campaign money more easily, even though that person has a pretty good name ID and maybe doesn't need those amounts of money to run for re-election? How's it work?
Well, I mean, I'd make the argument that incumbency is in many ways a disadvantage in politics today.
Really? Why?
Well, the more people I talk to, the more they're turned off by someone having been in politics for a long time. That was certainly the case with President Trump. I mean, basically was elected to the highest office in the land without any experience and basically without any kind of campaign. And here in Minnesota, you're seeing the third district, Dean Phillips, a complete newcomer, coming to the scene and being able to compete handedly with Eric Paulson, who's been in Congress for 10 years and having no trouble. Dean's having no trouble raising money and running an effective campaign. And I think if you look at the Senate race, you've got Corinne Housley, who's heavily outspent by incumbent Tina Smith, and yet she's nipping at her heels. So,
although, I mean, Tina Smith is a pretty new incumbent, just to be clear about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. But, at the end of the day, money only does so much, and it's really the quality of the candidate, the quality of the campaign. I don't talk to many voters who tell me they have been swayed one way or the other because they've seen a political ad. In fact, I've really heard the opposite. More people are turned off by them than anything. So.
And Andy, I was going to ask you, a lot of the elections are about change, but do you feel that there is a shorter tolerance among the electorate for, the people that we've sent, 4 years ago to Washington or 4 years ago to the state legislature? Like, there's an impatience for change, and when I don't see that, I'm willing to upset the apple cart and put somebody new in there. Is there something different about the way that feels today than it has in the past?
I think so. I mean, people are pretty disgusted with the tone in Washington. I think people are pretty disappointed with both sides, the polarization of both parties. And I think there's no question that people want change, and that's kind of a cliche. But, I'd put myself in that camp. We'd like to see a more productive Congress. We'd like to see more serious candidates. So I don't think that that's a bad thing. But voters, particularly in Minnesota, are very smart, and they pay a lot of attention. And, one of the disadvantages of being an incumbent is you actually have to do the work, and you actually have to make tough decisions.
That's right.
And it's easy for people to come in and, not having ever had to make a tough decision and be critical of those things. So.
I noted that you just said you'd like a more productive Congress. I mean, I don't know if you heard the first part of the show where we talked about with experience comes knowledge about how Washington works, perhaps comes productivity. I don't think this Congress is an example of that, but think about the job that you're in as a lawyer. The more experience you have, probably the better and more productive of a lawyer you are. So you can see this from both sides. How does that weigh out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it's good to have balance in Washington. I mean, having veterans around that understand the process, that are very serious about policy and legislating, is a good thing. Having fresh faces that have fresh ideas, is a good thing too. So I don't think you want to have too broad a brush when it comes to those things. But certainly, I mean, as a conservative, I'd like to see this Congress tackle entitlement reform. I'd like them to see them tackle health care reform.
And those are complex issues, right, that you want some experienced lawmakers involved in.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's why, I've been so supportive of Eric Paulson. I mean, this is a guy who's not a very good politician. He's a policymaker, and he works very hard, and his record of accomplishment is pretty serious. I think that's a good thing for the third district to have somebody that's pretty senior on the Ways and Means Committee. So absolutely. I mean, this is not reality TV. This is serious stuff.
Samara, just for your reference, the big, I think, debate going on within Eric Paulson's district, who, as Andy notes, is an incumbent, mm-hmm. is whether he truly represents what the district is. And you were saying this before, the demography of a district might change. The voter outlook of a district might change. That's what seems to be animating that race and some of the others here in Minnesota. And it's hard for incumbents, I guess, to keep ahead of that.
Yeah, and you know, as Andy mentioned, one of the problems that incumbents often face in their elections is that they have a voting record. You know,
right.
their opponent and their voters can look at how they've voted over the last 5, 10, 15 years, and they can point out the maybe inconsistencies or decades-old votes that may no longer match the wishes of the constituency. And now a challenger has no record. They can just tell you whatever they want to tell you, and that is a huge advantage.
A call here from Audrey in Minneapolis. Hi, Audrey. You're thinking about term limits, yes?
Yeah, hi. Well, originally I was very opposed to term limits. But in order for the federal offices to have term limits, I believe they'd have to go through a constitutional amendment because the presidential term limits were done through amendment. I'm almost positive that with the 25th or whatever. But at any rate, but when I stopped to think about it, when I looked at those Kavanaugh hearings, and I saw people like Chuck Grassley, who have been around for so long, and this caller before talked about him, these people are so out of touch with mainstream America right now. They are trying to push down the throats of Americans agendas that were popular 35 years ago. So I honestly believe that if we were going to look at term limits, 30 years, a generation, is enough time for anyone to be in one job. I mean, most people retire after 30 years,
okay, so
right?
So if you're talking about generations, I mean, what would be the term limit on someone like Chuck Grassley or Patrick Leahy, who, by the way, was also there when Anita Hill testified? I mean, what would be the fair limit then, if you want to put a generational frame on this?
Well, the caller just evinced my earlier point that, you know, Minnesota voters are pretty intelligent and well-educated. You know, at the end of the day, we have term limits right now, and that power is with the voters. So people can decide, hey, that person's had enough. I mean, I agree. I mean, when you look at that panel, could that panel use some fresh faces? Certainly. But the people of Iowa have the right to send, you know, whomever they want, and Minnesota does too. And, you know, at the end of the day, if someone's been there forever, kudos to the incumbent or the challenger to take them on. But I think, you know, voters are pretty intelligent. And if they want to, you know, vote somebody out because they think a fresh face is needed, then, you know, have at it.
Agreed. But Samara, I mean, this is the whole essence of the show. A lot of power comes with incumbency. It is not easy to put up a challenger, a serious challenger to somebody like Grassley or Leahy or whatever, all these people that have been there for so long. It is not simple to just go, well, throw them out if you're not happy.
Yeah, and you know, I am very sympathetic to the caller's, you know, general, you know, concern that some of these people seem like they've been there forever and they don't seem to be necessarily representing their constituents. But term limits are sort of an easy target when you're looking at the candidates that you disagree with. I mean, Joe Biden was in office for 30 years,
right.
For decades.
Yeah.
So, and
that's right.
So there's candidates that are politicians that people like, and there's politicians that people don't like, and often they're both in office for a very long time. So I don't know if term limits would necessarily solve the problem of, you know, getting people out of office who don't seem to agree with their constituents. I think we're always going to have those.
Aaron asks, if you do your job well, I don't have any problem with you continuing to do your job. President is such a unique and powerful position that unique limits make more sense than for Congress or legislature. Samara, does that make sense for you, too? We put an 8-year time limit on president, but that's not a compelling enough reason to limit members of Congress?
Well, you know, I think the basis for term limiting the presidency is very different from the lack of term limits for Congress people and senators, and that is because we wouldn't want the country to turn into, you know, a dictatorship. And the president, frankly, has a lot of powers that these Congress people and senators don't have. The president could use executive orders to their advantage, and without term limits, that could lead to some pretty undemocratic situations. So I think the offices are just so different that we can't really compare them when it comes to why one has term limits and the other doesn't.
Brooke says on Twitter, Andy, do your guests see any correlation between dark money in politics and term limits? Would term limits reduce dark money's influence? What do you think, Andy?
I don't think so. You know, dark money, the objective of dark money is to influence policy decisions, not just see people that are elected that they like. And I think, you know, we have real problems with our campaign financing the way we do it. Basically, people can give as much as they want without any kind of accountability. I mean, I think the way to do that is make it a little bit easier for people to take donations that are, you know, visible.
What? How would that work?
Well, I mean, like members of Congress, for instance, can only take so much from an individual. And so therefore, they have to spend a lot of time making sure that they, you know, raise a lot of money from a lot of people versus being able to take larger donations, in which case we know about that. We have that transparency immediately. So if I'm a politician and I've taken a big donation from someone, I'm probably going to be pretty darn careful that I don't do anything that looks like there's a conflict of interest.
I don't know. I mean, Andy, how do you explain some of the drug pricing policy when you see what Americans say about, for example, wanting Medicare to be able to negotiate for lower prices, and you see what Congress does on that? Those votes are public when they can be forced to actually vote on it. I don't know that transparency actually works in some of these cases.
I mean, Tina Smith is making that a very effective issue for herself in fighting those things. So at the end of the day, it's not special interests that show up at the polls, it's voters. And, we have seen it time and time again, politicians that make bad choices in terms of, you know, taking donations that don't look very good, it doesn't help them very much. So I think, again, I mean, we need to take a step back and remember that, you know, Congress is filled for the most part on both sides of the aisle with good people. I mean, these are tough jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, people put forward their names, they risk their reputation.
Yep.
It's a difficult gig. And, I think the vast majority of people that represent us on both sides are pretty good people just trying to do what they think is in the best interest of the country.
Andy, really good to have you on the show. Thanks much.
Thank you.
Andy Brehm with us, corporate attorney and former press secretary for U.S. Senator Norm Coleman. This is a question I had for you, Samara, about money in politics and incumbency. Do you think public campaign financing is one of the remedies to this? It would. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the sort of death knell of campaign financing is that it needs to be instituted by the person who just won the campaign. And people tend to not want to get rid of the system that allowed them to win. So someone's going to win an election with a lot of private money, and the first thing they do when they get to office is not going to be make all that private money illegal. So it almost seems like one of these goals that we're just never going to achieve if the people who are intended, who are supposed to implement it, are the ones who are benefiting from no public finance. So that's why I tend to, you know, would it help? You know, I think yes, that there would be benefits if money weren't such an issue in politics. If we could have more regular Americans running who don't need to have millions or billions of dollars, who aren't spending half their time in office fundraising, absolutely. I tend to think that, you know, the system we have is probably going to be, it's probably the way it's going to be for quite a while, simply because we haven't seen anyone. I mean, Barack Obama, for example, had lots of wonderful things to say about campaign.
That's right.
Public
first
finance.
Time
and once
around.
He got in office, he was like, absolutely no way. He was not willing, even while he was running, once he started to see how much private money he was getting, he was not willing to accept a public finance.
That is so frustrating. I mean, what that seems like is it's an issue that Americans care about. Could we have a true debate about it? I mean, we got a call from Keith asking, could we get something about campaign finance on the ballot? So we wouldn't rely, maybe in individual states, so we wouldn't rely on Congress to do this. I think there is an appetite for this. The candidates want to talk about the first time around. And then, as you suggest, once they're in office, this doesn't look so great because we hear things like, well, it will disarm, you know, it will disarm the campaign. I need all the weapons I can get to fight the other side, you know, that kind of stuff.
And, you know, Americans take their First Amendment rights very, very seriously, as they should. And for many Americans, the right to donate money is a real expression of their free speech. And so, you know, I personally would not predict that public finance is going to gain a lot of ground, certainly not among elites and potentially not really among the public either. But, you know, what we have seen, for example, Senator Amy Klobuchar is now donating the money she's raising to districts across the country because she's in a pretty safe district. She's probably going to be okay.
Pretty safe,
So, you know, we see these candidates who are fairly confident they're going to win their race, and they are now spreading their wealth to candidates who seem to need it. And I think that's a really terrific way for a party to operate. You know, figure out who's going to win and how they can redistribute their money. There was calls that O'Rourke should be doing the same thing in Texas. You know, if it looks like he's going to lose, then maybe he needs to spread his money around. And I think that's a really productive way for parties to think about their collective finance.
So this leads me to ask you about a show that we're doing tomorrow, which is about outside money. And because Minnesota is such a competitive state this year, we've got, you know, these highly competitive congressional races, and we have a governor's race, and millions of dollars have come in from outside sources. I hear you saying when it comes to fellow members of Congress, hey, share the money around. How do you feel in general about the effect of outside groups coming in to influence the outcome of races in states?
Well, you know, if you think about supporting candidates as an expression of free speech, which a lot of Americans do, then you would then you could argue that if there's a group of candidates who are supporting the movement that you support, who are all supporting the national message you support, then, yeah, it would make sense that you should be able to distribute your money around the country to help those types of candidates win. And if you have the means to do it, then I could see why that would be a really appealing option for a lot of people. And, you know, as Dan Hopkins at Penn has argued in a new book, all of these races, all these small races in the U.S. are becoming increasingly nationalized.
Yeah,
they're
for
all
sure.
Using the same types of message. It's becoming more of a national movement across both the Democratic and Republican Party. And with that is going to come, I think, a lot of spending outside of one's own district.
So I would argue that the problem with that then is the issues that are unique to, you know, Minnesota or Wisconsin or Iowa get subsumed under the overall, it's a national election, it's about President Trump. I mean, we have some urgent issues to settle here in the state of Minnesota. You don't hear as much about that on the campaign trail because it's been nationalized.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's particularly seems more problematic when you think even about propositions and referenda that might apply simply to one state. So, for example, California's referenda are often supported by big movements across the country, by, you know, more conservative movements in Utah, in Nevada, that spend their money trying to influence the ballot in California one way or the other.
Right.
And yes, of course, you would argue that they're not necessarily representing the will of that state, but they, you know, what they're doing is they're trying to increase advertising for their side and then let the voters decide.
I mean, at some point, I think you and I have talked about this before, the overwhelming avalanche of campaign ads, it's the law of kind of diminishing effect, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're especially in states like Iowa or Ohio, and you hear about people who put signs on their doors like, please do not enter, no canvassers are allowed, families turning off their TV. It's absolutely overwhelming.
Lynn in St. Paul called to say there's so much money in campaigns that you have to have the money to do it. This is for somebody thinking about running. She says the average person can't campaign, and once in office, they have great benefits and more money. Incumbents definitely have the advantage. At the beginning of the show, we talked about high-quality challengers. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that this is a year where the power of the incumbency has not scared off a lot of
people? You know,
I
haven't seen empirical data measuring the quality of challengers this year, and I think that is a study that is overdue, that is ripe. But it really appears anecdotally that challengers this year are doing very well. And, you know, I have a colleague at Arizona, Yotam Shmargad, who has a new paper arguing that social media actually is playing a significant role in helping these underfunded challenges narrow the gap with their more well-funded incumbents. So potentially it has to do with new digital media, new technologies, in addition to this growing and, you know, as I believe as Andy was saying, it's almost cliche now, but this increasing sense of dissatisfaction with the current American political climate.
Samara, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today. Good to
Thanks,
have you.
Thanks, Carrie. I love talking to you. It was great
Me too.
To chat today.
Samara Klar with us, professor of political science at the University of Arizona. Okay, we mentioned Paul Wellstone as a challenger to an incumbent. We also have to take note, as All Things Considered is doing this week, of the huge upset that happened in the governor's race in 1998. Jesse Ventura running a campaign. Listen to this ad from the campaign.
New from the Reform Party. Yeah! It's the new Jesse Ventura action figure. You can make Jesse battle special interest groups.
I don't want your stupid money.
And party politics.
We politicians have powers the average man can't comprehend.
You can also make Jesse lower taxes, improve public
education.
All
right, just a reminder, listen to All Things Considered to reflect back on that race.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.